Good evening, everyone. Welcome to Holy Crap, the vlogcast. Vlogcast that comes from a skeptical point of view to try to answer the questions of why. This vlogcast started as a series of events courtesy of Facebook, a combination of the Streisand effect and spite when somebody on Facebook finally said, look, why don't you just stop taking your logical, atheistic point of view and just let us post whatever the hell we feel like, because we like it, it's fun, it makes us feel good, even if it is just crap. It is May 4th, 2014. No, I'm not going to make the obvious joke. This is the episode dedicated specifically to phosphorus. So those of you that understand the periodic table of elements, if you're watching us on a phosphorus screen, good on you. Don't breathe that. Phosphorus dust.
I have one next to my LCD.
There you go. We're going to be talking this evening about cake. And since we don't have any cake, we're going to have to go with death. Some of you get the joke, some of you do not. I am known around the world as Shujin Tribble, usually is the Shujin Tribble. I am in my mid-40s. I was born in Brooklyn to a Roman Catholic household, raised on Long Island, now live outside of Buffalo, New York, and am an unabashed atheist. Thank you very much. Joining us this evening is Unrenowned Tech.
Hi. I am not known around the world, but I am Unrenowned Tech. I'm in Southern Maryland. I come from a mixed household, and I am an atheist.
And Witchy Bunny.
Hello, my name is Witchy Bunny. I am perhaps known around the world, don't know. I am an agnostic, and I currently live in the Philadelphia area.
Okay. Now, I know full well that we've pretty well covered part of this topic once before. It's going to be a little bit different because, like I said, this is a weird month for me, specifically. And that's really what prompted this one to have happen. The vlogcast, as you might recognize, does go through a lot of different pieces and a lot of different areas. Not all of which is religious in nature. Some of it has just got to do with just life, the living, and in this case, as we obviously see, death. May is unfortunately... philosophy, sure. May is a very difficult month for me in general, because in 2005, this was the month that we lost my wife, colloquially referred to as Fujin. Because in Japanese, it's one of those situations where there is a term that means for husband, Shujin, which is off just a little bit from a word for wife, Fujin, which is what we ended up calling each other. Just the same way that a lot of married couples have got, you know, their cutesy names for each other. That was ours. There's certain connotations. Like what now?
Pudding butt.
Sure.
Pudding butt.
Sure, yeah.
That's a pet name for a woman.
Okay, sure. We'll go with that. Anyway.
The Man Show. Come on.
Never seen it.
Oh, no my. Idea. Oh, geez.
Woman.
Oh, geez.
Okay. Anyway, the point of it is, this evening, since it is the month of which we lost my wife, May, I have a couple of things that I end up doing, not the least of which is getting ready for the Ride for Roswell, which is a fundraiser for the Roswell Park Cancer Institute here in Buffalo, but also I will be doing a 32-hour, I can count, online radio stream marathon, which I may... see about doing some hangout time also in the middle of all that. And for the, for helping people out when all is said and done. Now, this particular episode is not going to be about theism or atheism. It's got nothing to do with the afterlife. We're going to be talking about, like I said, specifically about death, and the prevention of, because there is a lot of stuff that has happened over the last months that has been absolutely absolutely amazing. So if you'd like to join us, of course, on air, sort of, please feel free to utilize the question and answer system. If you've got questions that you want to send over to us also via email, you can send them over to me at shujintribble@gmail.com. Twitter, Facebook, Skype, whatever you want to try to find me at, all under the name Shujin Tribble, and I'm basically the point contact all over the place over here. So, I don't really know where to kick off on this one in particular, so Tech, I'm going to bring it over to you first off anyway, because I want to kind of ease into this as much as we can ease into such a topic like that. I want to start off with pets. Did you have any that you had to deal with, or what was the closest thing to a pet that you had to deal with in this kind of standpoint?
I've had several pets, and I've seen almost all of them die firsthand. The one I didn't was a dog named Pepper. And Pepper was not, he was out laying on the carpet. He wasn't moving. He was breathing. He could bark. He could lap up water from a plate, wag his tail. His ears would perk up. He'd respond to the pets, but he couldn't move. And it turned out he had a tumor in his stomach, and we didn't catch it until it was too late, because when Dad finally got him to the vet, and they did a scan of him, as just before the scan completed, he died. So, but all my other pets, I've either woken up to them dead of old age. One, I was awake for her when she died. She actually went through the, she was a cat. She went through basically death motions of different muscle reactions and things like that. And I was there for her. She died in her sleep, which I'm very thankful for. And then we had one cat who had, I don't know if it's an embolism or aneurysm, but basically when people have something that goes wrong in their head and their body tweaks out for a minute or two, and then they expire. There's no foaming around the mouth. That didn't happen. But her body, it was just like there was all these signals got crossed and her body went nuts and she expired. That was freaky to see that happen. She was also a purebred, particular type of cat. I forget what her purebred was, but they were known to have issues, whether it was issues with temperament or biological complications just due to their breed, the way they were. And understand, my family doesn't go looking for purebreds. We happen to chance across them very often because we end up rescuing a lot of animals before they even get to the shelter. From the street, from the grocery store that somebody dumped them out in the parking lot, you know, things like that.
Yeah.
You know, the real jerks we rescue from. And, you know, against certain laws, I've actually buried pets before, and it's hard. My pets are members of my family. Not everybody understands that. Some people do. Some people understand that more than others. If you don't believe me on that one, just watch an episode of My Cat from Hell sometimes and see what people put up with for their cat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the truth.
Yeah. Okay. And
it's not an easy thing, I know. I'm
sorry. No, it's not that. I remember growing up thinking there was a heaven for a time. And it was comforting. I mean, it was definitely comforting. There is no denying that the thought of an animal heaven is comforting. But as a non-theist, as an atheist, as a rational thinker, what I do is I try to hold on to the memories that I have. Before I wasn't so upset when certain memories would disappear, when I couldn't recall certain things, because, you know, they're in heaven. I'll see them anyway. And now I realize, looking back, I was doing a great disservice to those memories. And now my memories are more important than they ever were before. I mean, they're not more important than the presence of actually taking care of people in the now.
True.
But taking care of those memories should be almost as important, to cherish them, to remember them, to share them with others. Like my dog Pepper. one of the most fondest memories I ever had of him was the fact that we had a dog catcher in New York who somebody called in something on our dog. And it was a false call. It was a fake call. Anyway, he got onto our property, and we had a sidewalk that went around the side of the house to a gate that led to our backyard. The gate was chain-link fence with a padlock on it. This is important. There was also a sign that says, "Beware of dog." Okay. Pepper was a big dog. There was a rose bush next to the house that he would hide in from time to time. And when this dog catcher came up, he tried to open the gate, saw that he couldn't open it, and for some stupid reason, reached between the bars in the gate, you know, because when you have a swinging door on a chain link fence, you have that gap there. And I don't know what he was thinking, because this was a padlock. He tried to fit his hand through there and started trying to jiggle the padlock to see if it would open from the other side. The intelligence level of this guy, you know, there's a reason why he didn't run for mayor. Pepper took that as his cue as, ooh, toy. And he sprang out of the rose bushes. And Pepper was over 100 pounds of muscle. And he was quiet. He was sneaky, like wolves were, you know. A pack of wolves can hunt very, very quietly. He was that kind of quiet. And when he sprang out, he scared the shit out of this guy. And I see the whole thing from my window, which overlooks the area, with my grandma standing next to me. And me and my grandma just start laughing our butts off. Looks up. He's yelling that he's going to throw whatever, sue or whatever. Now, my grandma, you have to understand, she never backed down from anybody. She was a sergeant in the Army Air Corps during World War II. She wore combat boots.
Okay.
And so she said, "You're trespassing. I already told you. Go away." Because apparently he had tried the front door before, and she had told him to get off the property, that the owners were not home. You were not allowed to be on here. You're forbidden from going into the backyard. So. Okay. So that's where that all comes from. And I'll never forget that memory of that. You know, just the patience that he had, the lining it up of everything, and the perfect timing of that dog. So, nice. You know, I share stuff like that, and he stays alive, and other people as well as me.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Bun? I know this one went a little bit long, but hey.
It happens.
That's actually going to end up being a part of this all, so no worry.
Hey, if he gets to the point faster than I do, then that's okay. I haven't had that many pets. I've had pretty much all cats. Not pretty much. I've had all cats. And I've seen one of my pets through to death in person, and the second one died while I wasn't here, in a circumstance that I'll share, but no one's going to be real happy with. But the one that I was more or less there for, we had had, growing up, I had, you know, the one cat that had some other name, and I named it Figaro after the cat from Pinocchio, because, you know, it's a tuxedo cat. So. So the name stuck, because, you know, who's going to tell the 3-year-old, no, that's not the cat's name. So that became the cat's name. And then we moved from staying with my grandmother into staying with my stepfather. And so when we got here, the first thing we did was we've always had shelter cats. So the first thing we did was we picked up a shelter cat that I chose. She was a calico. Her name was Gina. Gina proved to be a little nuts. Chewing through live wires repeatedly. I think we went through 6 sets of Christmas lights the first year we had her. Growling at anything that moved out a window loud enough to wake us up. It was an interesting time with her. And so my mom ended up taking her back to the SPCA. And then we got Ginger, who was a tiny, tiny calico kitten. Apparently there was this box of kittens that someone had just abandoned in a parking lot. My mom went and picked one up and brought her home for me. Well, Ginger had something. I never found out what. We had had her for about a week, maybe 2 weeks. when I went to, I came home and went to play with her, my mom said, no, she's not feeling well. And, you know, I was like, just leave her alone. And so I left her alone, and when I came home the next day, I was told basically that Ginger had been taken to the vet and she had been euthanized. And I was devastated. I bawled. I cried. I was so upset. Not really because of, you know, oh, you took my cat away, but because she was gone. I still form emotional attachments to animals far too quickly. and so, to make me feel a little bit better, I went out to Colorado to visit my aunt. And when I came back, my mom said, you know, I have a little surprise for you. Walked me in the basement door, and there was a tiny black kitten sitting on the basement steps.
Mm. Meow.
That was Lucky, which I named for obvious reasons. And she's the one I had the longest. And Lucky, I guess she lived to be about 13 or 14 years old. She lived to be pretty old. She was eventually put down while I was living away from Philadelphia in Arizona, actually, with my ex. So she got put down while I was away, and I was really upset about that for the longest because I wasn't there for her. If you've ever owned an animal or a pet, you know that, especially if you live in a house with multiple people, sometimes even though the cat may be your responsibility, it's not really your cat.
Right.
Like, it can be someone else's cat. Lucky,
especially with cats.
Yeah, Lucky was mine. We kind of grew up together. My mom would come into the room and, you know, see me batting at the cat, and she'd go, you know, stop messing with the cat. I'm like, well, she started it. And, of course, I get in trouble until one day my mom sees me sitting there watching TV, minding my own business, cat just walks up to me and goes, whap! She goes, oh, my God, the cat really does start it.
Mm-hmm. You know what that means, don't you? It wasn't that she was your cat. It's you were her human.
Well, yes, I very much was her human. And as she got older and started to mellow out, and I'm getting into teenage years now, and I'm starting to mellow out, and so, you know, we'd had this arrangement where Lucky, who was smart as hell, would, you know, get sleep with me throughout the night and get up, and then around like 4:30, 5-ish, go into my parents' room and lay down in their bed. And they'd get up and they'd see her and they'd, you know, go feed her as soon as they got up. My dad comes to me one day, he's like, you know, Lucky sleeps with us every night. I'm like, no, actually she doesn't. She sleeps with me all night, and then she gets up and goes into your room and make you think she slept with you all night so you'll feed her sooner.
Nice.
Very, very smart, sneaky, vindictive cat. And she was mine. And you know, I miss her, but
I had a dog named Lucky.
You know, usually it is a dog's name.
But he was all black too.
Well, that, you know, I don't even with that. No comment.
Just cool. That was just when you said it was a black cat, I was like, I have a black dog, same name. This is kind of cool.
Well, I mean, because I thought that black cats, you know, they're supposed to be unlucky, and I'm like, well, no, she'll just be lucky. And she was. She was my friend for years and years and years, and I miss her, but those two are the only ones. My previous cat I was not able to keep, so, I mean, he didn't die. He's got adopted out really quickly from the shelter where I had to take him, but, you know, she and I have discussed that, and so other than that.
Yeah, and that's not something that we're going to end up talking about on air, because basically it's just a whole bunch of BS.
And
we're
going to leave it at that. Yeah. Yep. But yeah, so I mean, I've seen two pets through to death, one prematurely, one not mature, not prematurely. She lived to be a pretty good age. So yeah, that's how it goes.
Yeah. Now, in my particular case, I've had a number of pets over the years. The one that I have the biggest heartache for was my first dog. When I was born in March, so when Christmas came up, I was about 9 months old. And my parents, we were living in the New York City area, specifically the very south corner of Bedford Stuy in Brooklyn. So if you ever listen to the... Oh, Jesus, what the hell? The Billy Joel song, You May Be Right. He talks about, I walk through Bedford Stuy alone, at Bedford Stuyvesant. We lived down there, and my parents had gone to the North Shore Animal League out on Long Island and had gotten a purebred, surprisingly enough, boxer, a girl. And we basically grew up together. And it breaks my heart because, even to this day, because I was 13, maybe, 12, and she was staying outside for whatever reason. I couldn't even tell you any longer. And I went off to school. I didn't go outside to see her before I left for school. Went and came back, and only to find out from my parents that she had gone.
Oh, man.
And there was nothing to be done about it, unfortunately, at that point. Now, the worst part, the part that absolutely kills me, is that I found out that my dad took her to the county dump.
Oh, geez.
And I didn't get the chance to say goodbye. I didn't get to see anything. I got nothing. Now, I don't know if it's a true story that's where he took her. I have always known that to be the case, but we're now talking about 30 years past, and I don't know if that's the case, and I really don't want to ask. But even 30 years later, it hurts. I mean, I can already feel tears in the back of my eyes already just thinking about it, because I loved that dog. I loved her. And there were pictures of us, roughhousing, or me riding on the back of her. And I'm, a year old, maybe, if that, and she's not even that. And we grew up together. And like a whole bunch of other people, it doesn't really much matter, in a lot of cases, what the animal was. It was a friend a lot of times. Even if it was a bird, a parakeet, a turtle, it doesn't really much matter. You have an affection. You have an acceptance that this life, no matter whether it's level of sentience, that life is with you, and you have a certain responsibility to it. Even fish, for crying out loud.
Mm-hmm.
Because, I mean, you have fish in an aquarium, and lost that one, really? Ah, man. As opposed to, okay, there's another one gone. Yeah. So,
sushi.
We can joke about that, and the little one that I have, we. But
what's a good name for a fish? Sushi.
Dory. How's that? The only problem is they don't ever seem to respond to it. I don't know that they necessarily remember all the time. It's a bad joke. But now here's the thing. With the topic tonight, the topic of death, the reason why I wanted to open with our histories with having to deal with pets is that they are not human family, but they are family. We treat them with respect, with love, we get attached to them, and we have to let them go. Sooner or later, we have to let them go, because it's, except for the, what the hell is, the gray macaw, I think it is? No, the, shoot, what is it?
African gray parrot?
The African gray, thank you. Where they live 80 years old. That's a lifelong investment.
Mm-hmm.
And that is one of the few pets, and I use the term loosely, where you may not necessarily outlive that pet.
Mm-hmm.
They may outlive you, and that's kind of where this comes together from. With our human friends and relations, we don't know how far out those lives are going to be with us. And a lot of times we kind of take it for granted because it's all too easy to do that, especially when you're young. Because I mean, who thinks of, you know, leaving, having to not have people to a certain degree. Now I'm kind of come backwards, Witchy. For you, humans, family, or even friends of family, what's the earliest you remember having to lose somebody that you knew on a personal level like that?
That would be my great grandmother, my Nana, when I was 11. And it was funny because I found out about it. It was the type of thing where it's situation normal until you get that first glimpse that something's not right. And for me, I was in the middle of class, and it was about 11 a.m., and I get an early dismissal. And I'm like, that's weird.
Mm-hmm.
And so I go downstairs to the office, and my stepfather was a correctional officer. So, you know, he had the uniform. And so I go downstairs, and there's my dad in his uniform.
That can't be a good
thing. And I'm like, yeah, this isn't good. And I get in the car, and we start driving, and my mom turns to me. She goes, you know, your Nana died this morning. And that was – and, I mean, it's weird because I was never particularly close to her, per se. I was the oldest great-grandchild for her, whereas, you know, all the rest of my cousins, just due to the dynamics of my family and, you know, my Nana having 7 kids, you know, all the rest of my cousins who were my age were her grandchildren, so they had that kind of greater attachment to her, and so it was just this really weird thing where I get there, and my grandmother's freaking out because they had literally just been to Atlantic City the day before and had come back, and now she's gone, and my grandfather's sitting there in a daze, and my cousins come in and they're crying, and I'm just, like, still trying to absorb, like, you know, what the heck just happened, like, you know, Nana was here, and now she's not, and that was for me the first time I really had to deal with that.
Yeah. Tech?
Shortly after I was born, my mother was in and out of hospitals for various problems. And by various problems, I mean like spinal cord problems, things like that. Okay, so we get the idea. She wasn't willingly doing it. It wasn't something that she had done to herself on purpose. These were things that couldn't be prevented. In fact, they were afraid when I was being born that she might wind up paralyzed for life during my birth.
Mm-hmm.
Not me, her.
Oh, yeah.
So anyway, she's in and out. And my dad's an IBMer, which means that while financially they were secure, wherever they sent him to go, he needed to go. You know, that's how IBM was.
Yeah.
You know, you did what you did for the company because the company took care of you in the process. Not like what you see anymore today, but I digress. So her mother, my grandmother, the one who wore combat boots... Yes.
Same. See, it all comes around.
It all comes around. I bonded with her in the way that a lot of children bond with their mother. And when my grandmother died, I was 11. Oddly enough, Witchy. I was at home. We knew she was dying of cancer. They didn't have cancer treatments back then. All they had was morphine. And my mom was at the hospital with my grandfather. And it was extremely early in the morning. Sun wouldn't be up for hours. Phone rings. Dad picks up the old rotary. Yeah, old school. And he gets my sister and I up. And he tells me that grandma died. And so we go to the hospital. And after adults are all whispering and everything else, we're allowed to go in and see her. My sister gives her a kiss goodbye. And I just look over there. I turn to my mom and I go, "That's not Grandma." And that was actually probably my first atheistic experience right there. The rationale, the logical part of my mind going, "That's not your grandma. That what's left is not her. That's just cells, organs, you know, a microcosm of living things still breaking down that haven't finished yet. Grandma is gone beyond what is in our hearts and in our memories." And I also went into depression at that point. Chronic depression kicked in because it was that traumatic for me. Just, I had never seen a dead body, let alone a family member. Mm-hmm. And so I remember the nurse was nice enough to bring me a little tiny cup of vanilla ice cream and a can of Sprite. And everything kind of moved along smoothly. I was very quiet, well-behaved. I kept to myself. I kept all my thoughts in my head, which scared the hell out of everybody else around me because they were worried that I was getting suicidal because suddenly I started getting an interest in death. I suddenly wanted to know everything there is to know about death. When people tell me, "Oh, when you die, you go to heaven." "Well, what's heaven? Well, describe it to me. How do you know? Well, where can I read about it?" You know, okay. And so I would start getting into books and everything else. I got into books about people talking about seeing the light at the end of the tunnel, books about speculation about people who were brought back to life after being dead, where they were doing astral projection, all sorts of stuff based on death. And the fact that I hung out with the headbangers and the deadheads, and you know, it probably didn't help my image too much with the adults. So it was very traumatic for me, but it also sparked an interest in information. I can honestly say that looking back, that did help me become the atheist I am today. I can't for the life of me remember the sound of my grandmother's voice, but I remember her touch. I remember her hugs. I can't remember the sound of her laugh, but I can remember what the smile on her face looked like when she was laughing, because I was very good at making her laugh.
Excellent.
So there are, like I said, there were certain things certain memories I didn't do justice to. Now, my mom, she does a candle in memory of her on the day that she died once a year. I, on the other hand, you know, I've got her picture on the wall. I pass by it every day on the way to my room to go to bed. And I look at it and I smile, and it's her picture from back when she was in the military. You know, she's got her uniform on and everything else. She's standing up straight and proud and everything. A lot younger than I remember, but mm-hmm. you can see, look at a younger person and see the person that they may grow up to be. Pattern recognition, facial. Your brain can do it if you know what to look for.
Yeah.
Some people can do it, some can't. I'm pretty good at it. I see that picture. It definitely traumatized me. I mean, seeing death is traumatic. And anybody who says otherwise is either holding it in or has seen so much death that they've been traumatized to the point where it doesn't faze them anymore. And that's a sad place to be in my opinion. And that's why, one of the things I feel that we don't do justice is our men and women who come back from wars. They've just been neck deep wading through death or the death of those around them, and they're crying for help for dealing with it, and so many people go, "You don't need help, buck up."
Yeah, that kind of thing is really a tough piece. And there's probably a whole episode involved with that, I would assume, and we can see about that one. We'll see about that one in the future.
My opinion is a little bit biased because not only was my grandmother a sergeant in World War II, but my uncle, my mother's brother, he was a Green Beret during Vietnam.
Yeah,
now he's still alive too.
Fortunately. All right. In my particular case, I can't remember exactly what it was, but in my particular case, because we came from an Italian family, quite literally from off the boat originally, or most of it was anyway, I had to go to a couple of funerals or wakes when I was a kid. I mean, 6, 8. I didn't really understand what was going on, so it didn't really hit me. But it was, I knew it was a somber, solemn thing, and I was dressed up, and okay, Grandma, what are we, who's, I don't know who this person is, so okay. You know, so you know, for me, really, my dog was really the first closest one. And I had to deal with my favorite uncle, who I miss terribly. My grandfather, who, again, I wish that I had actually gone into Brooklyn when I told my parents I was going to, and my mom told me, you know, don't take your brother out of high school because, you know, he can't miss it. You know, and I next day, you know, gone. And it really sucks. I mean, there's no two ways about it. And one of the things that you said, and it's going to sound really stupid, but one of the things that you said about how that's not her reminds me deeply of, this is going to sound stupid, I know it, one of the, I believe it was one of the first season episodes of Star Trek The Next Generation, when Worf ends up with a whole bunch of other Klingons who were looking to basically take over the Enterprise, and one of them died, and his reaction to, you know, what do you want to do with the body? It's just a shell. There's nothing there. Do whatever you want to do with it. Doesn't matter. He's already.
Okay, well, this predates gone. Next Generation.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. But the idea is that that concept transcends and it goes on for a lot of people. And that's part of the reason why I wanted to say that one is to tackle a question that had been put over in the Q&A. And by the way, if you're paying attention with us right now, first off, of course, thank you very much for your patience. A lot of these topics do take a while to really get through to really getting through the conceptualization of it all before we get to it. It's unfortunately, that's the niche that we're working through. The Q&A system is, of course, up and running for all of these Hangouts. And again, for those of you that took a little bit of extra clicking to try and find us over here, I'm sorry. I'm still really trying to find my way through this stupid thing. But Captain Wrongway, by the way, thank you. I'm assuming that you're not Reynolds, but some people get that reference, some don't.
Is asking,
you're welcome.
Or Peach Fuzz.
Don't go there. Don't mean from the Q&A. Quote, don't mean to cut to the chase. Don't mean to cut to the chase. And first off, you know, don't sweat it, man. Any folks, you want to go ahead and you put a question to us, by all means, feel free. And don't worry about feelings. Whatever it is, however you want to work it, we'll work with it. Don't worry.
We're big kids. We can handle it.
Don't mean to cut to the chase, but what are your collective opinion on life after death? For me, some people call that marriage. Tech, what do you call it?
The life after death?
Well, I'm sorry. Did I hurt you, buddy? Bunny, did I hurt you? No, she's just showing off the highlights in her hair. I'm sorry, you were saying, Tech?
I said that there's the belief in afterlife, in my opinion, is delusional. But at the same time, if you want to believe that delusion, I am not going to tell you that you're a stupid idiot for doing so. Because my mother had an experience in her life that was shared that... I mentioned this in one of the other, in the last death episode, that has convinced her that there is an afterlife. And it was a shared experience. It wasn't just an experience isolated to her. It was amongst her and another member of the family. And it is something that, you know, struck them and to their core. Can I say that there's empirical evidence? No. A personal experience does not hold up as empirical evidence. Well, I respect their claim that they experienced what they said they experienced, and that's why they have their belief in it. Sure. It doesn't harm me in any way, shape, or form. But I don't believe in an afterlife. I believe in the recycling of the physical remains, and I believe that we should go ahead and do that. I mean, after all, you know, we consumed a bunch of resources on this planet that was given to us by dying stars. We should be happy to give it back when we're done with them. Mm-hmm. You know, energy just recycles.
And Witchy?
This is one of the reasons why I claim to be agnostic versus full-blown atheist or whatever.
It's okay.
Because I honestly don't know. I can't see beyond the moment of death to what happens to someone afterwards. It could cease to exist. It could be something beyond. I acknowledge that I flat out don't know. And I'm not going to claim one way or the other. I'm basically going to say, no idea, not sure, and kind of leave it at that. Is it possible? Well, in a sense that anything's possible, maybe. Again, my answer comes down to, I don't know, and I'm not going to claim to know, and I'm not going to claim to have the answer.
Now, in my case, this is one of those things. I know I made the joke about the whole after marriage thing, and please forgive me. I like to fall back on a lot of the old jokes because I happen to love the old time radio stuff. So some of the jokes and whatnot that go back to like
if you want something like that, life after death is when you don't have to make child support payments anymore.
One way to look at it. In my particular case, to paraphrase from Noah from Scathing Atheist, and by the way, thank you very much for the stuff that you guys have done. I would love to be wrong. I would love to be absolutely wrong.
You sure about that?
About life after death. But I can't, for the life of me, understand how that could even be a possibility. Well, first off, the quote-unquote line of death, if you will, is an incredibly broad, nebulous point at this point.
Mm-hmm. The moment the heart stopped was death.
Yeah.
You proved that wrong.
Oh, my God. It used to be that. And now we have ways of stimulating the heart again, whether through electric or through...
There have been people who have been brain dead for minutes and come back.
Which is just absolutely astonishing in a lot of cases. And it's not understood. And that's one of the things that's amazing. But
there's brain damage in the process, though.
Well, yes, unfortunately.
Yes.
But the biggest problem of dealing with death on the terms of should there, could there, is there something beyond, everything that we have indicates that the answer is no. Now, that does not necessarily conflict with religion. Now, the question of is religion factual or not is immaterial at the moment. It don't even take that into consideration.
Yeah, everything we don't need an apologist viewpoint at this point.
Right, and at this point, what I'm about to say does not have any conflict whatsoever with religion, whether my observance one way or the other or anybody else's. Everything that we have currently shows up to the point of death, from a physical standpoint, perhaps even beyond temporarily. Like Tech was saying, brain dead has technically been thought of as being all dead to... Thank you, Mad Max. Miracle Max. Mad Max is a different guy. But...
Thunderdome!
But the idea that there may be an opportunity for consciousness to extend beyond is appealing. It is very appealing. And I would exceedingly like the idea that I had at one point to be true, that the electrical signals that are our mind, not the brain, because the brain is the physical part. The mind is the property that is who we are. A brain is what we are. Who we are, our personality and such, is the patterns that go on in between our ears. I would love the idea that for whatever quantum stupidity, that those impulses, those signals, that pattern temporarily or instantaneously, I never really understood it for myself. I would like to think that maybe for just that one instant, that consciousness extends everywhere and every when, so that you could conceivably see everything and be everywhere at every point in history, to see it all, to understand it all, before blipping into oblivion. Now, like with the idea of there being a heaven or a hell or purgatory or limbo or another plane of existence, it all comes down to, I got nothing. I got no way of having that be the case. But it's appealing. It's nice to think that maybe for just that one extra instance, my wife knew all, could see all, could understand it all, could know what my life was going to be like, what her daughter's life was going to be like, her progeny for the rest of whatever would be like. But we have no way of even ascertaining if that's even a possibility. Because at this point, everything that we have says, once you're cold, that's it. And really, that's the piece that I want to concentrate on for the rest of the show at this point. Not what that line is, but up to that point, what do we do? How can we really take the life that we've got and maximize it?
Quit smoking.
Oh, God, quit smoking. Drinking to excess.
Quit smoking. Yeah.
That's a good one. That is an exceptionally good one. I mean, I've joked that if you really want to be a smoker, sign up to be a volunteer fireman and, go in without SCBA.
Well, that's not allowed.
Well, no, it's not. But, I mean, really, it's all the same carcinogens that are getting blown into your face. More so in some cases.
Yeah, but then you have to wait for something to burn down. At least with a cigarette, you can have that on a whim.
Well, that depends on what city you're in. I mean,
to be quite honest,
cigarettes are just controlled arson. That's all.
I've never heard that one before. That is brilliant. Thank you.
She pulled that from a joke about a guy with a bunch of cigars. But anyway,
yes, actually, I did.
I know you did. The appeal of the cigarette when I was growing up wasn't the fact that the cool kids were doing it. It was the fact that I really liked the smell of it. And when I tried it for the first time, I liked not only the smell, but the taste of it. I liked the tobacco flavor before it was burned and after it was burned. And that's what truly drew me into smoking. It wasn't trying to fit in like a lot of the cool kids. That didn't hurt me picking up smoking. That didn't hinder me from picking up smoking. But it wasn't the primary reason. Enjoyed it.
Hold on. Before you get past that, you said that you quit. Roughly how long had you been smoking?
Cumulative total of all the years I've smoked, counting years where, okay, I quit for two, picked up for one, quit for another two or three, because I've been on again, off again, but with much larger intervals than the average person. Mm-hmm. And cumulative total, I would estimate that I've smoked for at least 17 years of my life. because I started smoking when I was 15.
That's
I started when I was 16, so.
Yeah, and I know for
$1.50 a pack.
Yeah, I remember my mother had been, my grandmother, her mom, had told her when she was like, well, my mom telling me the story. When she was in high school, I think it was, her mom told her, look, if you want to smoke, I will buy them for you so you don't get who only knows what from who only knows who. Which I get. You consider that it was the 50s? Yeah, it would have been the 50s. You could have gotten some weird stuff, but at the same time, yeah.
My parents were real simple about smoking. They would not buy them for me. I would have to do that myself, and if I got caught in the process, I would have to pay the penalty for doing so. That it was bad for my health, and that they hoped I never did it. And I was not allowed to do it in the house, nor was I allowed to bring them into the house.
See, I'll go on, Tech.
Even though they were smokers.
Yeah.
They didn't want the same for me. That's all.
The funny thing is I was sneaky about it. When I first started smoking, I would sneak a cigarette here, a cigarette there from my parents' packs. And eventually, I just started going to a place near my school that I knew didn't card and buying the same cigarettes as my parents, that if there was an extra butt or two in one of the many ashtrays littered around the house, they wouldn't notice. And finally, when I turned 18, I started branching out into other brands because I was 18 now, legally I could smoke. And so my mom found out through one of the butts in the house, and she flipped out, oh, you shouldn't smoke, you're this is terrible, don't do this. And of course she's a smoker, she's still a smoker. And, you know, this is terrible, don't do it, blah, blah, blah. And my dad's response was more, oh, you ever tried Winston's?
I used to smoke on my school lunch break because our school, to help prevent kids from smoking in the bathrooms, because they hated that.
Mm-hmm.
What they did is they set up two areas off of school property that was not owned by any of the surrounding area, businesses or homes or anything like that. And they were marked somewhat casually. So they weren't obvious areas. And we were told that if we must go have a cigarette, since our school allowed us to go off school grounds for lunch, because there was a Burger King down the hill and all that other fun stuff. And mind you, this is a high school, not a junior high. That if we went over there and we smoked over there and we kept our cigarette butts over there, they would not call our parents, and we would be left alone.
Which makes sense. I mean, if you are off of their property, you are not...
Right, but technically it's also, in a way, promoting smoking, because they're saying, listen, if you go over here, we won't tell on you.
Well, yeah, correct.
It depends on the case. And we live in a different time we did now than we did back in the early 90s.
And even the 70s, too. Yeah, I mean, yeah. There was a big difference... it used to be, and a lot of people don't recall this, it used to be that there were cigarette vending machines in a lot of places where it was, you know, you put in your...
It wasn't just a bar that you could get them
in. No, you could get them in... I remember seeing them in the bowling alley that we used to go to.
And there was a restaurant...
However much.
There was a restaurant in Apple Lake, New York, called The Villa. It was great. They had a wonderful salad bar and wonderful pizza. And the first thing you saw when you walked in that door right in front of you was that cigarette vending machine.
Yep.
And that one was nice because you could actually buy not just a pack, but that was one of the rare machines where you could actually buy a carton.
Oh.
Wow.
I haven't seen one of those since I was very, very little.
It was
old. Oh, goodness.
Wow, for a vending machine, I had never seen one of those. Only packs and only cardboard packs, but that's a whole other issue. We're back on it. Okay, so smoking bad. Okay, kids smoking bad. Crossing the streams bad. Okay,
just keep that in mind. Drinking can actually be healthy for you, depending on your body. If you look at the Italians, I'm going to reference the Italians because I am part Italian.
Aren't
when
we
you
all?
Have, when you
no,
have,
I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I have to take that back. No, we're not all Italian. In some cases, we're all Genghis Khan, but we'll talk about that one later.
Yeah. Anyway, a glass of wine with a meal is not uncommon.
True.
But then again, their meal consists of fresh vegetables, freshly made pastas that haven't been sitting on a grocery shelf for weeks on end, made with God knows what chemicals and all that other crap and preservatives. You're talking about freshly made pastas that, you know, digest well, fresh oils that are actually good for your body. Fresh, well, not all cheeses aren't fresh, but you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Instead of pasteurized American cheese, you're getting something off of that was aged in a cellar and cut off a wheel, you know. Yeah, some really good cheese. But well, the thing is the same way in France too, you know. They have fresh breads and fresh vegetables and fruits and things like that. And you have a glass of wine with it. It's actually very good for you to live that way. Now, if you're diabetic, yeah, maybe not so good for you. If you're anemic, the red wine is actually good for you in small quantities, not large quantities. You can't drink the whole bottle and expect it to solve your problems. But a little bit of red wine a week with a little piece of red meat a week can help your anemia leaps and bounds better than most medications can.
Yeah, and what I was going to say is, folks, don't think of us as experts, by the way.
Yeah, we're laymen.
Biological chemistry and such. I have heard on several occasions that the idea that different stabilization chemicals are okay or not, different versions of sweeteners are okay or not, it's one of those things where I just don't want to get into a pissing match with people who are just saying, hey, by the way, didn't you read this particular article about blah, 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 blah. No, we are not chemists. We are not biology teachers or researchers or anything. We are lay people. So yes. Don't go yelling and screaming that, you know, we don't know what the hell we're talking about.
Now, here's where my information on the red wine and the red meat comes from. When I say steak, it's got to be... first off, you can't cook the crap out of it and expect it to help. This was told to my mother by a doctor when we were living in New York, and I was anemic at the time. And I ate once a week a little piece because I didn't want to eat meat as a child for some reason, although I love it now. I loved my vegetables. You know, I loved eating vegetables. I liked ice cream, but I just didn't want to eat meat. I went through a stage, and that stage caused me to become anemic. I wasn't born anemic. It was I developed anemia by refusing to eat meats. And now I'm sure there's a vegetarian or a vegan out there who can go, well, if you eat this vegetable, you would have been fine. Yeah, nobody in my family is a vegan or a vegetarian. We would not have had that knowledge at that time. The doctor told my mother that I should eat about 6 ounces to 4 to 6 ounces of a rare cooked piece of steak once a week. And in doing so, my anemia did go away. I wasn't taking pills for it or supplements or anything else like that. The only change in my diet at that point was that addition to the 4 to 6 ounces of rare cooked steak that my parents had to coerce and threaten and plead with me to eat so that I would stop being anemic. But one of the other things the doctor says to my mother was, I had also recommended the red wine, but he's not 21 yet. That's where my knowledge comes from a doctor making the recommendations to correct a health problem that I was experiencing at a time in my life. Now, you have to understand, this is back in the 80s. Whether this is still true or not, I do not know, but I do know that I have my son, since he likes meat anyway, I make sure that part of his meat intake is actually a piece of steak. That is rare. That is for about 4 to 6 ounces at least once a week when he's in my care.
You know what? I think, hold on, before you go on to the trip, I think one of the things that we can really sum up with all this is, you want to be healthy, eat healthy. Make sure that you get a whole bunch of different things. Well, no. You get some of a whole bunch of different things. Variety is arguably one of the best pieces that you can make sure that you do.
Yeah, and if you eat pizza every day, you're just screwed.
Yeah. And I will admit, I've not exactly been the best of cooks on a lot of occasions. It happens. But at the same time, you know, you make sure that you get a little bit of everything and you do a lot better for yourself when all is said and done. We are, we got about a half an hour left in the show. Those of you that are still with us, of course, thank you very much. If you'd like to take advantage of the question and answer system over here on the Google Hangouts, please, by all means, feel free. We can see what kind of questions come up as we get through to the end. If you've got something that's a little bit more involved that you'd like us to cover, or ideas for future shows, please send them to me as an email to shuchintribble@gmail.com. And like I said, I'm the point man for the whole thing, and we'll see what kind of comes of all this. One of the other pieces that I wanted to make sure that we hit very specifically is the stuff that is really helping us in the living times. For instance, like I made mention to, next month in June, June is the Ride for Roswell, which is a fundraising campaign for the Roswell Park Cancer Institute here in Buffalo. Am I inviting people to join my team for the ride? Abso-freaking-lutely. And I will tell you why. Because I made a promise to my wife in her last moments. And I will never forget the moment because I was there with her, as was her mom. It was 7 p.m., the 22nd of May. And mom was trying to tell her, you're not supposed to do this. Kids are not supposed to go before their parents. And I was on the opposite side of the bed. And I said, Mom, no. And I took Fuji's hand and I told her, it's okay. You fought the good fight. It's time. You can rest now. And what I told her that I say on many an occasion now is, you rest. We will beat this for someone else. My word. And I am not gone back on that. And I refuse to. Because what got her was a rare cancer. Now, a lot of people are not familiar with the Roswell Park Cancer Institute, RCPI. RPCI. Yeah, I got it right. Is analogous to, in New York City, Mount Sinai, or like St. Jude's, or, there's so many different places. But RPCI is a cancer research hospital. They treat people. They have done some stuff that is, technologically speaking, forgive me, not safe for work for a moment, fucking amazing. Something called a gamma knife. That sounds like it should be something out of science fiction, and it goddamned is. They are able to do robotic surgeries around the world from their facility. They have people that are researchers who have been there. Fuji's oncologist at the end was someone who specifically went to RPCI to study a specific type of cancer. And
look what we've done with
it. It was amazing.
Have you seen what they've been doing with nanofilaments? With carbon fiber tubes? They can get tumors to travel down that to another spot, to a petri dish, and literally reduce the size of the tumor to a point where they could actually operate on it.
Yep. Now, Bunny, I've got the camera on you for a second because I want to see, I want your reaction specifically on this one.
Okay.
One of the fellow ham radio guys, we don't know him personally, but a fellow ham radio guy had figured out that, you know full well, that radio waves propagate because of stimulated emission through electronics.
Right.
Well, one guy had figured out that if you were to cut nanofibers to the right sizes, they would effectively become sympathetic vibration receivers. Guy figured out how to inject nanofibers into cancerous tumors the right wavelength so that you could then pump the right radio wavelength in there. They get stimulated. They vibrate. What is vibration? Vibration is heat.
Holy cow.
And so cook the tumor and the cancer cells from the inside.
Better than that, figured out how to cook those suckers without affecting anything else nearby so long as the fibers ended up staying inside. And if you can inject directly into the cancerous tumors, boom. Now, as a ham radio guy.
Very cool.
My God.
Yeah, no, so here's the thing. How come we haven't started using stuff like this? Like the technology where a young lady figured out that if you inject molecules of gold into cancer cells, into cancerous, you know,
growth
collection groups of cancer cells, you know, where they've created a lump.
Right.
You inject molecules of gold in there, and you then treat the area with the cancer treatment chemicals. What happens is rather than the usual time frame going by before it before these drugs and chemicals and whatnot being carried away by the bloodstream, they stay in the area longer because they're attracted to the molecules of gold. They actually attract the chemicals to the cancer.
Nice.
Right. And this is for, and it works on, it was, the paper said that it was tested with commonly used cancer treating chemicals.
There's a lot of stuff, especially with cancer, treatment-wise, that is positively mind-blowing. Like I said, inserting fibers at the right wavelengths to accept the wavelengths of radio waves in order to heat them up, almost like a microwave oven would do, but safely. Using the body's own chemistry in order to attack tumors. The chemical that the medicine that Fujin was on near the end was something that was experimental, because at her point there, it was an opportunity, and why not? Because we went into her backup.
It's like the experimental leukemia treatments that they've been having success with. They only use it on patients who have tried everything else.
Because you don't have too much of a choice.
Yeah.
The cancer that she was diagnosed with was something called angiosarcoma, which is a bloodborne. It's one of those things where it's, even though angio is heart, generally speaking, accepted as, it was more a matter of a blood vessel. So it went to a lot of places, but we'll talk about that another time.
I have a friend down here who lost his wife to it just about a year and a half ago.
Anyway, my condolences, truly. The medicine that she was experimentally on was called Avastin. Now, we've heard about Avastin in the past. If I remember, prostate cancer was one of the big ones that they were working on. But the... this was something that was used by, and I sincerely hope he doesn't mind my using his name, Dr. Michael Wong. was the gentleman. He's now out in California, last I knew. He is an MD, PhD. Beautiful, wonderful, beautiful, wonderful person. I do not call him Dr. Wong. I call him Michael to his face because he understands I respect him too much to limit him to being just called doctor. He's Michael to me. In the labs, the Avastin on her tumors was amazing. And I truly to this day believe if she had gotten that chemical 6 months earlier, at the least, we might still have her. However,
spread too far, huh?
Consider the what the Avastin did was it prevented the tumors from growing feelers in order to feed itself. And this is at the time it was a brand new category of drug. Anti-angiogenesis is the category, and that is a mouthful, believe me. It took a while to wrap our heads around it, but the idea was it would prevent it from growing out new tubules so that it couldn't feed.
It would starve itself to death.
Bingo. And in the labs, her form of that cancer had a specific chemical lock that was caught by the specific chemical key in Avastin. And in the lab was brilliant. But you needed to have that specific chemical combination to make it work that way. And what ended up happening was, think of the idea of taking a bottle of wine and putting it on its side and shrinking the cork. There were so many nodules in so many places that she basically bled to death, basically, or started to, and they had to take her off because she would have. Yes. And they got the information that they needed. Think about it this way. You know how when you go to the hospital, you'll see everybody's got their charts and they're in one of those 11 and a half by 14 or 14 and a half by 11 file folders. And, you know, they got the two hooks up on the top and they put the sheet on it, bend it down, and everybody's got their thing. Mm-hmm. Her active folder was this thick. And that was only one volume. And they had multiple volumes with her information. Is that scary to see? Oh, yeah. But it is also much more information that they ever had. Because for Roswell Park, her type of cancer for them, they described it as one in a million. So the fact that we went through what we went through is painful, absolutely. But the research that they were able to do with our full knowledge that we were going in with a 20% survival rate at one of the most preeminent cancer research facilities in the country, perhaps even the world, we knew that we were behind the ball. And we knew whatever happened, we were going to end up doing something that will end up helping other families later. Maybe other families in the same position that we were in. And the worst part about it is, for a lot of cancers, including that one, there's no way of knowing what triggers it. Now, there are some that we know full well, you know, there are things that trigger it. But this, they have ideas, but they're still not certain. Could it have been the box factory that she was working in on her off time from college? Maybe. Could it have been the plastics they were using? Maybe. Could it have been something in the groundwater? Who knows?
Could it have been her vaccinations?
Which we know full well is not going to be the case. But you're right. There's no way of truly knowing what it is that ended up happening with that. But to help others, that is the biggest piece. Because, like I said, 20% survival rate at 5 years, you know full well the numbers were against you. So we looked at it from the standpoint of, we will do, we will try, we will work with it as best we can. And people will learn.
Now I have a question for you.
Shoot.
After her passing, after everything wound down to a stop, as it were, how many people did you get that pretty much just said, I'll pray for you, and that was kind of the end of it, versus people that were, they said they would be there for you, and actually were there for you, encouraged you, spoke to you, show up unexpectedly and say, hey, you know, how you doing, or invite you over to their place, you know, even whether there was a firm set date or a completely loose set date, you know, of whenever you want, you hop right on over, we'll be fine, we got a spare couch, you know, whatever the case might be, you know, that kind of thing. How many of each type of support do you think you actually got?
There were a number of people who offered their help, and several of which were able to do. Now, unfortunately, in my particular case, we live out here in the boonies. I mean, we are quite out in the boonies by comparison. It was a 40-minute drive from where we live to get to our PCI every day. And even from where we live, it's almost 15 to get to something that resembles a highway. So it was a tough thing. But there was some family that was able to help. There were some friends of the family that were able to help. But the hardest part about it was that I didn't know what to do. So, and I've told people this before too. There is an expression that I basically adopted for myself. Sometimes pure survival is a noble enough goal. And that's what I did. I concentrated on do what needed to be done every day. Get up, be with the little one, feed, clothe, bathe, play, rest, nap, eat. You know, do the things that needed to be done. Get to the end of the day. Go to sleep. Get up and do it again. And just keep at it. Because the repetition, even though it can be monotonous and you may not necessarily see the end, at least each day you have things that you need to make sure that you do. And even if it is repetition, even if it is annoying, at least you get what needs to be done. Even if you do it on autopilot, and each day you get a little bit stronger. Even if it's only a micro amount. But every day you get a little bit stronger. I didn't know what I needed done for me. And I didn't know how to convey that to anybody else. So for me it was like, you know, thank you. You want to take the little one for a couple hours? Okay, I'll go take a nap. Because really that was the biggest piece. Just trying to rest. Because even till today, I mean, I've not had the knockout, drag-out cry that I probably still have in me somewhere. But
it took me, and I can say honestly say this, it took me 5 years before I actually full-out cried over my grandmother's death.
Yeah.
5 years of reading books about death and asking people about death and having people, you know, giving me, whatever.
Trying to find your way through. It is a huge, huge, monstrous pain in the ass. And that's why I, even to this day, even though it hurts, and again, Bun, I'm putting the camera on you again on this one because I know that you've been quiet, and I know a lot of this is hard for you emotionally because, I mean, let's face it, it's not easy for anybody emotionally for this kind of topic, but I think that you would have, your reaction is probably arguably going to be the best of us all. Even after all of this, even after, and I'm going to lay this out because the transformation is the biggest piece. 12 years of being married, my one true, the person who completed me, who went to, who put through the worst with me and the best with me, who went to, who took me to Japan with her effectively, and we went to Australia together, and went to England together, and went to Toronto together, and got lost in New Jersey together to finally get to the goddamn place and finally made it, and had a kid together, and fought for 3 years almost together, and finally losing that and being devastated and going on autopilot for years to get through to this point 9 years later to where I'm able to help others to not have to go through this, to help others to learn, to have a daughter, her daughter, who is easily, and you've seen, one of the smartest, brightest, funniest, creative, amazing human who you can see, like I've said before, you can see how amazing a person that she's going to be.
Oh, yes.
When all is said and done, even though it hurts, we will still have an amazing story and amazing information and good help for the rest of humanity when all is said and done, even though it sucks hugely. The expression of, you know, making lemonade out of lemons? No, I mean, yeah, burn down somebody else's house with lemons. I had to do that. I think even with the pain of it all, I think that we're going to make the absolute best of a absolutely horrific situation and end up making something as good as possible out of it all. And you've had the chance of meeting her.
I have.
Somebody who's gone through all that we have, what do you think? We done okay?
I think you're doing amazing. I really do.
And now I want folks to understand, I'm not asking for this because I'm trolling for a compliment. It's that we are emotional creatures, all of us, and it hurts. Oh my God, does it hurt? But it doesn't mean that you have to be completely crippled with everything that happens. It is not easy to go through these things. But you can take what happens and you can make the absolute best out of what has happened and in some ways probably end up helping others. And that's why I want to end off with talking about one person in particular. And it's somebody that I had, when I was doing my my history newscasts, the flashback newscasts, I talked about this woman a couple of times before. And she was featured on NPR a while ago, and that's why I found out about her. And this is the woman right here from her Wikipedia page. This, let me extend this a little bit. If I can actually grab the damn screen. There we go.
That's better. Use two hands.
This is Henrietta Lacks. Most people do not know who she is. She died in 1951, and she was being treated at one time for cancer. I've forgotten off the top of my head what type of cancer. I believe it was uterine. Anyway, they took, at the time, samples of her cancer in order to do experimentation on, to try to find out, how do you beat this thing? And remember, this was the late 40s into, you know, the early 50s. So the technology that they had at the time available was basically take a radioactive pellet and put it in the tumors and hope to hell that it destroys the tumors. In her particular case, unfortunately, it did not work. However, what they found out about her tumor was amazing. Her tumor turned out to be an immortal cell. Her tumors, the samples that they took from the late 40s, early 50s, are still in existence today.
Mm-hmm.
The vast majority of her cell line is still being used for preeminent cancer research to this day. And even though her family did not understand what it was that they were using her cells for, she, through her torment, through her disease, research has been done. Incredible amounts of research, hundreds of thousands of tests, because of her, even though she did not know what it was that she was contributing to science, even though they didn't exactly explain it to her, and the family did not understand it at the time. But this one person and what she went through and what her family has gone through has assisted untold hundreds of thousands, untold millions very likely, because of cancer research on her line. And most people never knew her. Most people never knew the person that her contribution comes from. Didn't even realize it. And even the researchers themselves probably only got a passing information about her. That, you know what, if you're working with these samples, the Gila line, this is who it is from. You probably didn't even get that much. And I told you that to tell you this. A few years ago, Michael got in touch with me. He was out in California, like I said, and he was teaching new students. And he wanted to ask me if he could use our story, if he could quote us, if he could use our names to explain to the new research students what it was that they were doing, why they were doing what they were doing, why they were researchers, who they were fighting for, what the stories were of the families that they would be affecting and influencing later. And my answer to him was, you tell these kids what they're doing and why they're doing it. You tell them anything and everything you want about us, because they're the ones who are going to be stuck inside of an office, inside of a laboratory, without windows, without any way of talking with the people that they're going to be affecting, who they're going to be influencing. You explain to them that they are actually directly helping families and preventing exactly what happened with ours. You make sure you let them know. You tell them anything and everything you want to. Because if it helps them, if it keeps them going when they don't want to be doing and they're not sure what their influence is, what the good is that they're doing, they need to know. Because they will be working on stuff for years in some cases and not realize what it is that they're going to end up doing. Let them know. Tell them anything and everything that you want, anytime. Because they're the ones who are going to be the front lines. And if they influence others, if they tell others about her story, and they keep going, That's what it's all about. I don't think I can do very much past that at the moment, except to tell you guys about one last thing. And it's not about me, so this one is not trolling for anything. There's a custom in Japan. You don't put pictures of people who are alive up on your walls. You do that for the people who are no longer with us, to remember them. Because the idea is that if somebody is alive, don't have to be reminded. You need to actually see them. You need to talk with them. You need to spend some time. You need to interact with the people who are still here and enjoy your time with them. The ones that can't be here, that can't talk with us, they're the ones you need to keep their memory alive by seeing their picture. So the people who are still with us, let them know. And if there is somebody who is unfortunate enough that you know full well that their time is limited, take the pictures. Bring an audio recorder of some kind. Talk with them. Take the time to be with them and give them the opportunity to share the pieces that they want to share, so you can have their voice. How much would we give to be able to hear the laugh of some of our loved ones, to hear that story that you've heard time and time and time again, just one more time, to hear them give you a hard time about, why didn't you press your shirt when you came in? Why couldn't you do that for me? Why did you use your tie that way? Didn't I ever teach you how to do a double Windsor? What's wrong with you?
You get the jumbo eggs. I asked for the extra large.
Exactly. But we have people with us now. Don't lose touch with that. And I don't remember where Captain Wrong Way has got a wonderful quote. I don't recall where it's from.
Yeah, you need a citation for that, Captain.
Yeah, please. Before we get clear, but the quote is this: to live in the hearts we leave behind is to never die. Hold close the memory of those who go before us and let them live on. The funny part of it is I could easily attribute that to any number of people. And the funny part of it is I could think of it as like George Burns, but it's too eloquent for him. So, be that as it may, I think it's about that point. And I know I kind of monopolized the very, very end. Forgive me. It's my show, my rules. This is the way it
goes. DJ but, Rule Zero.
Yes. And we'll talk to you guys about that a little bit later. As always, Witchy, like I said, I know that for you, these kinds of things are a little bit tough to talk through. So, thank you very much for your time and plowing through and keeping with us. I really do appreciate it, hon.
It's my pleasure, Shujin.
And Tech, also for you. Thank you very much, man. I appreciate your time.
No problem, guys.
And for all of you who are listening and watching at this point, thank you very much for your time. We do greatly appreciate it. And we know full well, as we've said on many an occasion, these shows basically fill a niche of taking the time to really go slow. And for some people, that's exactly the speed that they need. And for some people, you know, you want the quicker, faster, and we understand that. So thank you very much for taking the time to go with us. The next show is scheduled to be May 11th of this year. I want you guys to understand and know that, 2 weeks from now, we're going to be taking a bye week while I am doing the fundraiser for the Ride for Roswell. If you would like to join my team for the Ride for Roswell, I'm going to see about putting a link in the description field for the show. I ask you to give serious consideration to joining us as a virtual rider. You don't have to go out and do bike riding. You can just sign up to be a virtual rider, be a fundraiser, or you can donate directly to us. The fundraising group is called End of Cycle for Sarcoma. It was a... Fooch hated the name. She really, really hated it when I came up with it. And I really tried to come up with something else. But the more I thought about it, the more I thought, you know what? That's it. That's exactly what it is. If you can be here in Buffalo, love to have you. Love to have you.
Team Glittery Puffy Pants?
No. But,
Team Sparkle Tackle Pony?
Thank you.
Thank you. Team Amish Wolverine.
I was gonna say, better than Amish Wolverine. Come on.
Anyway, I'm going to, like I said, I'm going to put the link in the description field so that folks that would like to sign up or to donate, please, by all means, please. If you would like to donate in Second Life, I'm going to see about having some donation points available at various locations. There's one already available at Feline Conspiracy in Second Life. I'm going to see about putting one up over at Xanadu also. If you are in Second Life, if you would like one of those donation points, and if you would like to help by streaming the shows, the 36-hour marathon, please get in touch with me. This is never going to be an easy topic. The loss of the people that we grow accustomed to is not at all an easy one. And I can well imagine that in the future we will end up having similar topics or tangentially related topics. Holy shit, I got that out. But don't think that you're alone. Don't ever, ever, ever think that you're alone in the grief, in the pain, in the loss. We have all lost people who are incredibly, incredibly influential to us and incredibly close.
Although it's a lot okay. of people claim to have found Jesus.
And it's okay. We're not going to tell you that you can't believe in whatever. What we will tell you is, like I say at the end of the shows, I wish you the peace I no longer have. I wish you the strength that I've learned. I wish you well. Now that you've heard about some of the story, I hope you understand just how earnestly I do wish that for everyone. I really, really do. So until the next show, which... You know what? I have a hard time really committing to a lot of these shows and topics because I got stuff going on, and I apologize for that. But I had been thinking about it, and I'm going to go ahead and use one of the questions that was posed to us from Ross for next week, and I'm gonna go ahead and put it out there for us now. It's a long one, so I'm going to have to truncate the topic. But the email questionnaire about this one was as follows. The Bible contains vast allegory, historic, and cultural situational contexts, and countless language idioms from the time it was written. Why then, like both atheists and Ken Ham do, read it word for word literally? Well-educated theists and denominations read it as it was written to be read. Allegorically, historically accurate in parts, and with a deeper theological intent first and foremost. Therefore, should one have some formal education or not before cracking open the book and interpreting it? That sounds like a really good topic and one that we're going to talk through next week.
Well, I think I just had a...
You may have actually tempted me into being on the show next week during my trip. Thank you, Shujin.
I'm sorry.
I think I just thought of a Harry Potter reference.
No.
Yes.
I have no idea where you're going on this one, so we'll deal with it afterwards.
All right.
But join us next week, and we will see how we can attack this this particular topic one way or another. In the meantime, again, thank you very much. We hope that you take very good care of yourselves, and I am still working. Well, we're still going to see about having Jake Far Wharton join us. We're going to see about having guys from Scathing Atheist again sometime. Lucinda specifically, still have to get her.
Woohoo!
And I'm going to see still. I still need to see about getting Dr. Rachel Dunlop, Dr. Rachy from Australia to join us sometime also. If you have questions, comments, or if you just want to drop information to me, again, choosingtribble@gmail.com. Be looking forward to seeing for all of you. And in the meantime,
may the fourth be with you.
Talk about
you didn't do it. I was going to.
Yeah, well, thank you. And by the way, Nova, first off, thank you very much. Wow, talk about getting in at the absolute last minute, literally. Always nice listening in. Quote, death smiles upon us, so why not smile back? May everyone's end be full of music. Thank you. Thank you very much. And consider this from a fan fiction that I was reading. And I know this is going to piss off people left, right, and center. I'm sorry, but I just found this too funny. One of the fan fictions I was reading had to do with the My Little Pony universe.
Remember, pony wears the saddle.
Wait. And the person was talking about if you are a human who has crossed over into the pony universe, it's okay to smile with your lips closed. Because if you smile with teeth, that's a predator's smile. If you're going to go ahead and smile at death himself, smile the predator's smile. And as I've said, when the pale horseman comes for me, he's going to have to earn my ass. Because I will not go quietly into that dark void.
What do we say to the god of death? Not today.
And like I've said before, if I die and I am wrong and there is a great deity, he, she, it will have plenty of time to recount and make an accounting of oneself before I pass judgment over he, she, it.
Thoth, if you're watching, we'll see you at the scales. In the meantime, as always, truly, I wish you the, on behalf of us all, I wish you the peace I no longer have. I wish you the strength that I've learned. I wish you all well. Until the 11th, thank you for watching, and we'll see you then. Fujin. Matane. Drink with me. Good night.
You've been listening to Holy Crap, the Vlogcast. Feel free to leave a comment on the show's website at holycrapthevlogcast.com, where you'll also find links to our Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, and Google Plus pages. Theme music provided by Kevin MacLeod at incompetech.com. On behalf of all of us here, thank you for listening.